Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Statins are a group of cholesterol-lowering medications that have been found to reduce cardiovascular disease and even mortality in those that are at high risk. Despite these benefits, some patients are electing to stop taking them, which makes me wonder about the whole issue of making decisions that affect our health, which are some of the most important decisions we make. Is the decision to avoid statins a wise one for most of us? On this edition of Line One, Your Health Connection, we're going to discuss the risks and benefits of statins, as well as some ideas to help improve all of us make better healthcare decisions. Our guest is Anchorage endocrinologist Dr. Casey Kaltenborn. I asked Dr. Kaltenborn to come to talk about this issue after he presented the very same information, perhaps in a little bit more broader way, to a group of physicians recently at a lecture. During this program, at any time, you can reach us with questions and comments. If you live in Anchorage, our number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Casey, welcome back to Line One. It's a pleasure to have you.
It's great to be here.
So let's start with the basics. What are statins? I made a little brief comment. Tell us a little bit more about them.
It's a medication that is taken orally that decreases the production of cholesterol and is probably one of the best medications that we've ever been able to offer people to decrease their chance of dying of heart disease. And the difference in the way a hospital looks and the way a clinic looks now compared to when I first went into practice is enormous based in the use of statins. The heart attack rate has dropped very much during these 30 years. I think we all remember the days where people would fall over at their workplaces and we would lose somebody every week from different factories or businesses. Mm-hmm. That's really a thing of the past. And anyone who was a physician training 30 years ago remembers those days when someone would come in with a heart attack and it would be watching someone drift down a river and your fingers would separate and they'd be washed down the river away from you because nothing we could do would stop them from dying of the heart attack they just had. The pain that tough guys will describe when they're having a heart attack is they are in so much pain that they will just, and these are people that are used to tough guy stuff, will say it hurts and they cuff their voice because it's so painful they don't even want to take the effort to talk normally. It's something to be avoided, and it's different now compared to 30 years ago. And one of the main things, perhaps the major one, is statins.
So it makes me think of in my lifetime, we're both of similar age. We've been at this long enough to see some dramatic improvements of the use of what we would call the meningitis vaccines for Haemophilus influenza type B and pneumococcus. We used to see cases of meningitis several times a year in a general outpatient pediatric practice. Now I haven't seen one in probably 10 to 15 years. Dramatic changes. I had not really appreciated what you said was very reminiscent of that when you talk about statins, though. I knew death from heart disease and amount of heart disease was decreasing. I wasn't exactly sure why completely in my mind and had planned to show it sometime about that. But it sounds like statins are a big part of this story.
That and the reduction of smoking.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the things I would have attributed things to if you asked me on a test was smoking, yeah. So how do statins do this? What's the mechanism?
Well, they interfere with an enzyme that produces it. Mm-hmm. And then the arteries that are subjected to the cholesterol going by them are less likely to close and are less likely to accumulate cholesterol in their walls over time. Mm-hmm. We used to think it was a chronic thing that took months or years for it to make a difference. But we now know that there's an acute effect where the statins decrease the chance that the final block of the artery, the final plug, let's say, of your sink, when it blocks up with water, with the last bit of food particles that stopped your drain, that mm-hmm. it was one final thing that did it, but it had accumulated over time. Well, these drugs seem to stop that final clotting process that blocks the artery and kills the heart muscle.
It's not a rupture of the plaque that suddenly triggers blockage?
It definitely can be that, and statins decrease that from happening as well. We think of as an anti-inflammatory effect that molecularly, from a molecular point of view, we have yet to exactly work out.
And the reason, and answer this one then also for me, is there pretty good evidence that cholesterol plaques are more prevalent in the current culture than they were 50, 100,000 years ago?
Yes, because we had, in the era just before I would attend medical school, we went through an era of learning about medicine through autopsy series. And then as they did autopsy series, these are people that would die of various causes, and it would be kind of a random selection of the population. They watched that change over time until some hallmark studies looking at soldiers in the Vietnam era, where they were alarmed by how the arteries looked different during that time.
I can remember some studies even on Egyptian mummies where they could identify cholesterol plaques, but now those were a select group of people maybe having a richer diet than the workers.
Or it's a gene. So I think some of the spectacular cases that you can look back to, even Ernest Shackleton, one of the heroes of many of us who live in the far north, every other Alaskan lists him as their top hero, died of a heart attack despite a lifetime of very vigorous activity. Right. It was probably a gene that got him there with cholesterol.
All right. So there might be genetic predisposition. There's diet. There's activity. What are the risk factors? Who's going to benefit from these medications?
Well, that brings up a question about how to identify whether you could benefit from a statin. And it eventually, in all of us, becomes a rather personal decision. Usually a statin, when started, there is no particular reason to stop it. And, I mean, if you knew you were going to go before a firing squad in 3 months, you might stop it. But otherwise, you continue it for life. So it's a rather grave decision for most of us to decide that we were going to embark on a pill a day for the rest of our lives. So we have evolved a risk calculator, which is one of the things I would say about it. It is a way to keep people off of unnecessary statin therapy. And one of the messages I'd like to make sure that people listening here is that rather than being a bland promotion of statins, first of all, to say that they are one of our best medications ever invented, one of our safest medications ever invented. But on the other hand, there can be enthusiasm for using them that extends past what we know is scientifically justified. And so anybody listening now can, if they're accessing a computer, by the time I'm through with this following sentence, we can find it. If you Google CAD risk calculator, you'll come up with several websites, some of NIH, some with the ACC, which is the cardiology group. And you enter your age, your sex, your cholesterol number, your blood pressure, whether you're on blood pressure medications. And in some of the calculators, your HDL, you do not have to be a physician to do this. There is no charge. And it then generates what your CAD risk is. And
which CAD is cardiovascular or coronary artery disease?
Yes, thank you for calling. Yeah, that's not obvious. And coronary artery disease is the blockage of the artery that leads to heart attacks. And the same process extends also to strokes, although it's not quite as dramatic a link, but definitely is there. Statins decrease stroke as well. And so if your risk exceeds 10% for sure, most physicians would say a risk greater than 7.5%. And sometimes the enthusiastic people looking at public health would say, well, if everybody with a 5% risk, for example, in Alaska were to have a statin, that we would see less death rate. But that a lot of people would be getting treated. So somewhere between 7.5% and 10% CAD 10-year risk is where most physicians would say that it would be worth doing. And this would, of course, be the case if you've already had coronary artery disease. Many times if you had a stroke and if you have a condition called claudication where the arteries to your legs aren't sufficiently open to let you walk normally, all of those would be indications for being on a statin even without doing the risk calculator. But with it, you then know you can decrease the risk. Now, there are going to be people out there listening who may be on a statin who don't reach that criteria, and never stop a medication without talking to your physician. But if you don't risk, if you don't reach that cut point of 7.5%, you might talk to your physician about whether the burden of being a chronic pill taker is worth it. And by the way, doctor, if it was less than a 7.5% in you, would you take it? Mm-hmm. And I think probably it would be fair to say that every family has someone in it who is on a statin or probably should be on it. And that I would say that there's probably a 10 or 20% chance that certain young people, that people, let's say, less than the age of 50, if you're on a statin, there would be a reasonable chance, 10 or 20%, that you might not reach that cut point, and you should look at maybe unburdening yourself from it.
So I guess I'm trying to conceptualize this and also think about it from the listener's standpoint. Is what I've heard you say is we have dramatically improved the outcomes of people with cardiovascular disease due to cholesterol problems, whether it's genetic, diet. We didn't talk about whether it affects that related to smoking or not. And so it's a considerable group of the population. And you were saying even before the program that age is one of the factors, so that maybe age alone may risk you into the benefit of taking this medication. And the other side of the coin is what's the risk of the medication and what's the risk of not taking it, which is something I always like to talk to patients about. The risks, you said, are very, very, very minimal, but we're going to talk about that a little bit more in a second. And the risk of not taking it is determined somewhat by these risk calculators. They're going to tell you what's your risk of having some bad outcome within 10 years, is what you said.
Correct. And then with the risk factors that go into the calculator are things that you might intuitively know increase your chance. Smoking, the presence of diabetes, having a brother, sister, or a parent that had a heart attack at an early age, you know, less than 60, 65. All of those would put a statistical risk on you. And I talk about the analogy of this as if driving 55 miles an hour is reasonably safe. Well, what if it's icy roads? What if it's 2 in the morning? Mm. What if there are moose on the roads? What if your tires aren't good? Mm. Then 55 all of a sudden becomes quite dangerous. And so a cholesterol of a certain number, let's say 260, may be something that is a substantial risk or a minimal risk. And in one of the risk calculators that I looked up, if a 45-year-old woman has a cholesterol of 240 and an HDL, which is the good cholesterol, of 40, she has a 1% risk of heart disease and coronary artery disease in the next 10 years. And taking a statin would reduce it from 1% to 0.7%. Most of us would shrug it off and say, not worth doing that. If it's a 60-year-old male with the same cholesterol numbers, a cholesterol of 240 and an HDL of 40, he would have a 12% risk of having a heart attack or a CAD manifestation in the next 10 years, and that would decrease from 12 to 8%. And many of us would start to think that might be worth doing. Mm-hmm. So it's the same numbers, mm-hmm. and it's a different set. So male versus female, and males are always at a higher risk, and then the 15-year difference in age between the two. So you age into it.
Let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line One, your health connection. My guest today is Dr. Casey Kaltenborn. We're talking about statins, the benefits of statins, the risks of statins, and eventually we're going to wander into this very difficult area of making medical decisions. But right now we're concentrating on statins themselves, the pros and cons, and the indications. If you've got questions or comments, you can reach us locally over the next 45 minutes or so at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So this medication is one of the safest medications around. What do we know about the risks, and how well do we know those risk factors are real and have been worked out? How do we know that information?
Well, first of all, if you compare it to using aspirin or Tylenol, you would have to say that they're much safer than either of those two things, which are over the counter. Aspirin causes brain bleeding, stomach bleeding, deterioration in renal function. As you age, it becomes a much more dangerous drug. It has to be used judiciously. We used to give it to people to prevent heart attacks in general. Now we no longer recommend it, only in selected cases, people who've already had heart disease or stents. Tylenol, the number one or two cause of liver transplant because of toxicity using too much of it, acetaminophen, both more dangerous than statins. The statin hazards, I think, are mostly related to people who have significant risk factors right ahead of time. Renal impairment, kidney problems, the creatinine being elevated, the GFR being deteriorated, for those of you who are following those kinds of numbers. So something wrong with your kidneys, already on multiple medications, being an older age, and then being on certain drugs which are known to interact, such as cyclosporine, which is an anti-rejection drug. And then if you are on other kinds of cholesterol medications at the same time, those that are used to lower triglycerides, then you have to be concerned about interactions. Also, even what otherwise would sound like an innocent treatment of niacin, which is a vitamin, at high doses can interact with statins. So most of the interactions we see occur in them, although it's quite rare to have none of those risk factors and then have a significant side effect. The significant side effect is a overt breakdown in muscle where the urine turns orange and your blood enzyme goes high, and you can have your renal function, your kidney function, deteriorate. So you are usually hospitalized until you recover. I have never had a case of it in my practice. When I was an intern, I took care of a case. And so it happens, and that's the rare thing that we have to be concerned about. There's a statistical increase in the chance of developing diabetes. So people who are using statins compared to those who do not, a few of them will flicker, maybe one in 500 into right over the edge of having diabetes. But those are people whose blood sugars were already, we believe that it's very likely that most of the times this happens is that their blood sugar went from 118 to 126, which is the cut point for the diagnosis. So it's not a, the problem didn't come out of the thin air. It was just a little bit of a straw that broke the camel's back and cut you into the diagnosis of diabetes based on the sort of speed limit diagnosis of a fasting blood sugar 126. So those are the biggest ones. And about 5%, 4 to 5% have muscle symptoms that can be dealt with by choosing certain medications within the class, reducing the dose, looking for drug interactions. And but the trouble is that over my career, we've gone from a time where patients would come in and say, please, doctor, I'd like to be on this medication. Thad, do you remember those days?
I'm a pediatrician.
Yeah. Well, now people come in and say, please, I do not want to be on these medications. Yep. The drugs are the same. The doses are similar. Right. The gene hasn't changed. Our genetic makeup hasn't evolved. So something else has changed about how patients look at medications that are started for life. And have gone from enthusiastically wanting what they read about to telling you enthusiastically they absolutely do not want it, and that's definitely happened with statins.
I perhaps was too curt with that question when you hit it, me is asking, you know, have people stopped, used to ask me for statins. And what I have noticed in my lifetime is that there was a cultural bias towards wanting some sort of treatment. And now I see a cultural bias in general against treatment if I can get by with it across the board. You know, many people would rather not have an antibiotic if they don't need it. Most people would rather not have any kind of medication. Whereas it seems to me when I first started, it was I came to you about wanting something. If you're not going to tell me I need something, I don't think you know what you're doing, Dr. Woodard. So how much to, is that? Maybe that's a different way of answering your question.
Right. And we were talking also before how in our parents' era, you would go to the doctor if something hurt or something didn't work. And now we have the sort of public health view that going to the doctor is a good thing and you must follow all the advice, even if you feel perfectly well. And I think that's been there's been a pendulum response to that, pendulum shift.
Timothy, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, I've been listening, and I my doctor about 8 years ago wanted me to be on a statin, even though my overall cholesterol number has never been above 200. Right now it's at 150. And I don't know the exact LDL, HDL numbers, but the one that's the good one, was that the LDL?
HDL.
HDL. She said
highly desirable.
Okay.
Yeah.
And my good one was fine, but my bad one knee was right at the edge.
Yep.
Now, I started to take the statins when I was with another doctor, and I'm one of that people that I feel awful when I take them. My muscles hurt, and it's like I refuse to take a drug that's going to make me hurt, just to, you know. And I didn't feel my cholesterol was that out of whack.
Right.
It couldn't be maybe controlled some other way.
Right.
I'm also diabetic. See, I'm 6'5", and I weigh 300 pounds, and I'm 61 years old. And my HA1Cs for the last 8 metabolic panels have been below 6. And the last one was right at 6, and I just did one the other day we don't know the answer to yet.
Right.
So my point or my question is, it seems like sometimes doctors just want to automatically throw you on statins, whether you need them or not. Mm-hmm. I happen to be one of the ones where it hurt me or it didn't make me feel well. I never continued taking them, pushed past it. I just said, the heck with this.
Okay.
And, you know, I eat a lot of oatmeal. Maybe that helps.
Well, I'm going to, as being a pediatrician, I am not going to try to address this issue, but I bet this is very similar to patients that Dr. Kaltenborn deals with. So let's see what he has to say.
Sure.
The you're in a risk group over the age of 60 as a male, and you have diabetes that would make it a strong consideration to use a statin. And you've also described that your cholesterol numbers are nowhere near what any one of us would consider elevated. So you would ask the question, well, what would be the benefit of a statin there?
Yes.
And it turns out that in a situation such as this, it may be the anti-inflammatory qualities of the statin that would decrease that final clogging of the artery that could cause something to go wrong. And it may not be so much a marker based on what your cholesterol is and then changes to, but rather the anti-inflammatory quality it has on those tricky little arteries that we all have as we age that can clot down. And this would be a circumstance where I would recommend that you go on line and find out what your 10-year CAD risk is. And there's a way of looking at this that I've developed is you find out what your risk is. You assume that risk will be reduced by 30% from using a statin, and then you make that decision with your doctor and perhaps someone in your family who is a loved one who cares about you. Because it's easy for us guys to be kind of cavalier, you know, the sort of soldiering on type of way of looking at life. But, you know, someone in there to kind of listen with you. And then look at that risk reduction. So, and the one I gave you where the cholesterol was 240, the HDL 40, that patient didn't have diabetes. But with diabetes, the risk goes right up, no matter how well controlled your A1C is. And so it might be that your 12% risk of, I'm just guessing here, 12% risk drops to 8%. And that, I bet you the numbers are something similar to that. And you could look at that, get some real numbers, and make a judgment decision based on that.
Does it matter how much you weigh? It seems like the heavier you are, maybe the worse it is for you.
It's not one of the independent risk factors. There are some studies that say that it seems to be. Others that it's a confused answer there. But I would say it's not. It's in none of the calculators is it entered.
Okay, because you know I'm about like 50, 60 pounds heavier than I should be. So, all right.
Whoa. Wait, just a second, Timothy. What about the fact that Timothy says, well, I've tried these things and they don't make me, I don't like the way I feel. How should that get into this equation of do I or don't I?
Well, that I think hits at the center of why I'm here today and why I put together the Grand Rounds lecture, and my colleagues gave me some good feedback that it was a valuable thing. Earlier this year, a study came out in JAMA. So if we're looking at our best medical journals, we would say from an internal medicine point of view, not talking surgery here, that's one of our top 5 scientific decision-making journals. And in it, one of the best studies of people who couldn't take statins, I think probably the best study ever done with a substantial expense, with a large number of people, which was 500, followed for 20 weeks, looking at the question of whether the statins cause muscle problems or not. And the conclusion is that the majority of patients who ascribe statin muscle symptoms can't sort it out from a placebo when they're when they don't know whether they're taking one or not.
Mm-hmm. So some other factor other than the statin was causing the pain when you have the same percentage of people have the pain on something that shouldn't is nothing, is a placebo.
Correct. One might say it's something like if you were told that you were going to get a you either were going to get or not get a, let's say, a vitamin that might have a mild contamination of arsenic, let's say. And you were saying, well, the chances are you're not going to get the arsenic-contaminated vitamin. Wouldn't it be likely, as you took it, that you might start thinking that you were going to get those side effects? Mm-hmm. You look them up online and go, arsenic
now,
does
now
this.
You're saying that it's psychosomatic, meaning that you anticipate it
and
so you feel it?
The word psychosomatic and the word placebo are always, they have this negative connotation that somebody knows something more than you do. I think that if you are afraid of something happening, that it's more likely to happen. I mean, the prototypical thing when you're having a child learn how to bicycle, the thing you're not supposed to say as a parent, well, don't fall, Jimmy. Don't crash your bike. And of course, that's immediately when they do it. So we all get muscle aches, and we all are a little concerned about this idea that we should take a medication for life. And but the majority of patients weren't able to tell. And these were patients very well selected. These were patients who none of them had just intolerance to one statin. They had tried most of them, 85%, had tried three different statins, and not mild side effects. They said their life was intolerable taking them. And then randomized, the majority of them could not sort out the placebo from the active drug. Mm-hmm. So and that, I think, fits in with what most of us physicians have observed, where over time, the ability for us to have people be enthusiastic about taking medications has gone from, please, doctor, I want to take it, to, please, doctor, tell me I don't need it.
Mm-hmm. But you also...
All I can say is that I'm one of those type of people that I read the label inserts and I read all the warnings. But if I was to, like, stop doing that, I mean, we could never do a straight-up placebo. You know, here, doc hands me a pill. Here, take this. It's okay. Sure, doc, I trust you, and then just eat it. I anything that's going in me, I want to know what it is.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a wonderful point, and one that I had a great discussion with one of my own patients, and we were discussing this very issue, and he said, you know, doc, what it is that we used to be, you got your information from your doctor. It was too hard to find it otherwise. I mean, there always was the Merck manual, but most people didn't have it and didn't understand how to get much out of it. But now people get information from all kinds of sources, and it takes a lot of time to learn how to use them in a way that is productive. And it reminds me of the thing which I always sympathize with physicians getting what we call the medical student syndrome. And I would say that 80 to 90% of physicians, maybe all of us, get the medical student syndrome. At some point in our training, we read about an illness that we convince ourselves that we have. And this is not a mild thing. I saw a study on this recently that it's quite disabling, that for several months, physicians will be getting tested, need reassurance, seeing experts. And the one that I convinced myself I had was Parkinson's disease. So it's very difficult to use medical information in a way that doesn't cause distress. Mm-hmm. And so all physicians have gone through the ability to convince themselves they're sick by looking at things in textbooks. Mm-hmm. And one of those things that you go through to become a physician is to learn how easy that is to have happen.
Right.
You know, my doctor said that my degree trumps your Google degree.
Yeah, Dr. Google, I've heard it called.
Yeah, Timothy, I think this is very important information. There's no question that I would go online and say, and most physicians would love patients to come in very knowledgeable about what's going on. And the more we are all starting from the same place, the better. But one of the things that bothers me in that is physicians hopefully are better at being able to tell the quality of the information that they're looking at versus the public. And one of my really pet peeves is these package inserts, which really tell you the percentage of things that have happened that may not even be related to taking the medication. And I don't think we train patients well enough on how to look at that that information. You'd imply that you look at the package insert. I would say that's not really probably the best place to be getting information about your particular risk of taking that medication.
Yeah, the inserts have all kinds of legal reasons for being written the way they are, and regulation reasons. And I have to say that I think that information about drugs that's being transmitted to physicians, much less to those of us who don't have medical degrees, has coarsened and worsened over my career. And my pet example of that is a diabetes medication called Actos. If you look at it, within the first three things that are listed that the drug causes is upper respiratory infections, a.k.a. a cold. Now, there is no medication that you and I can come up with. There isn't one where we'd say, oh, let give them this so they'll get a cold. There isn't one we have. Mm-hmm. And yet, and it's not only with that, but it's listed with multiple. And the reason is the FDA, in their concern that something be missed, has to list everything that happens to the patient who's using the drug, even if that side effect doesn't exceed what happens in the placebo arm.
Right.
So you get it's thrown a lot of junk into the transmission of information, and that subtlety isn't there for hardly. Right. It's hard for physicians to understand this because we don't think like the FDA does.
Yeah. And it biases.
I have to go here. I just want to guarantee I'm the kind of patient that if I have questions, I write it down, and the next time I see my physician, I ask. Every time. I never just think I know anything, and I always qualify or quantify questions.
There's some links on our website that really gets people to good websites to help you work through these. Where do you get the information that you can rely on? So I'd encourage you to go to Alaska Public Media, look at the Line 1 link in today's program to look at some websites to help you do that.
Thank you, gentlemen. I got to go.
Thanks for your call. All right. We are already halfway through this program, and I want to let our listeners know that they're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number, again, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a one-minute break, and we'll continue our discussion on statins and a little bit about medical decision-making with Dr. Casey Kaltenbord. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic today is statins, those cholesterol-lowering group of medications that can reduce significantly, we've heard, cardiovascular disease and mortality. Despite these benefits, there are patients electing to stop them. We're going to discuss the risks and benefits of statins and how you might go about making the best decision for yourself as to whether you should be on or not on statins. And helping us do this is Anchorage endocrinologist Dr. Casey Kaltenbord. You can email your questions to us over the next 30 minutes at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number also, you can call us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. But remember, if you're listening to this program between 8 and 9 on a Monday evening, then you are getting a taped broadcast. We will not be able to help you. All right, we got another call. Sheila, you're on line one.
Hi. I'm a person that doesn't read the insert, actually, because I don't want to know all the terrible things. And I went on statins, and I felt like it was an appropriate diagnosis, and I was happy to be on them. And I started to experience a lot of pain in my legs and a lot of aching. And I went off of them, and then I tried to go on just a little bit, like just see if I could handle a little bit, and the same thing happened. And so I guess I would challenge that very sophisticated study, just writing off people who've had kind of a problem with it, because my personal experience is I didn't arrive with a predisposition. I've taken other medication. And so I just think for listeners out there, I think that there needs to be at least some knowledge or acknowledgement that at some level there may still be a problem with these things.
Well, let me respond myself before Dr. Kaltenborn does. He did say that best evidence is about 4 to 5% of people may have some muscle pain with these. And that we really have to be careful if this medication is so successful as to what are my options and not quit too quickly. We haven't talked about it yet, but it may be true that within that group, certain medications cause more likelihood to cause muscle pain than others. And then it gets to be an individual decision. So let me, Casey, get you to respond to Sheila here.
Right. Well, there's a difference between an individual and statistics. But the article from Dr. Nissen and Jama said that 45% of the people who were intolerant of 2 to 3 statins did identify it correctly, but half didn't. Mm-hmm. So, and then depending on how you nuance the remainder of that study, it may be that even 60 or 70% were tolerating it, and the placebo was just as bad. So, was the concern that they had. So what they had symptoms from. So that doesn't dismiss anybody, and there's a 5% risk. And some of the ways of dealing with it, first of all, do the CAD risk calculator. Make sure that the assumption that you are at enough risk to justify it is there, because that's one of the things I like to be there. I'm certainly not dismissing anybody, and I want people to know if they really do need that. One of my favorite things to do is to see, particularly women, because they're the ones that oftentimes are on it because they're the healthcare utilizers, because they have traditionally been having babies, getting pap tests and mammograms, all the things, and they are caution oriented perhaps more than most guys would be, and they get more medical care, they get labeled and get on drugs. And one of my favorite things to do is to say it isn't justified. Women are highly protected compared to men. Men die twice as much. So right off the bat, as a woman, there's a reasonable chance that your CAD risk isn't high enough to justify it, and then the whole thing becomes a moot point. So don't start with that. But there are other things to do. I haven't talked about what the drugs are, but I'll throw them out there. There's lovastatin, which is Mevacor, pravastatin, which is Pravacol, simvastatin, which is Zocor, fluvastatin, which is Lescol, atorvastatin, which is Lipitor, and rosuvastatin, which is Crestor. Everything gets a double name, darn it. And what we know is that Pravacol and Lescol are less likely to produce the muscle symptoms. And some people will be able to tolerate it as alternate day therapy. In the Chinese population, we think of reducing the statin by a half dose. That particular subgroup seems to have a lack of the enzyme which clears it. And then you can take a drug once a week, which is particularly long-acting, which is the last one I mentioned, Crestor or rosuvastatin, and that actually can reduce the cholesterol substantially taken once a week. Some people take even tinier doses twice a week. Those are some of the things that can be tried.
Right. Yeah, I think that's very constructive. I didn't mean to react, but it just the ending of the last conversation just sounded like, oh, it's in your head. I think that there is definitely people out there that have real problems with it who would very much like to participate in it if it's going to be helpful to their health.
Yeah, and there are ways to address that that many people haven't discussed. And perhaps, Casey, you might want to – how would you address a patient who comes in and says, look, I took one of these, I felt bad. What do you tell that person who definitely fits the category of someone who needs it? What would you next do?
Well, I would look at the CAD risk and assume a 30% reduction and see if they thought it was worth proceeding with that.
Mm-hmm. Would you try a different statin?
Yeah, that's a common thing to do, but I would go to one of the ones which we statistically know is less likely, the Lescol and the Pravacol, and then quite quickly go to the Crestor once a week. And the other medications that are used to lower cholesterol, it's hard to be enthusiastic about any of them. Mm-hmm. The longer, even though they are out there in the era of statins, it's almost a disservice to use them.
Is there another way to try to assess the validity of a patient's complaint of muscle pain? For example, looking at muscle enzymes, anything else? When muscles are injured, they spill out some of these proteins that we can measure, even with exercise, for example.
Unfortunately, that's been looked at by a consensus of experts, and measuring the muscle enzyme CPK to try to figure this out and make sense out of it is not helpful. Using the coenzyme Q10 as a supplement doesn't work also. There is no way. And in overt cases, which are rare, the urine turns orange and the CPK goes into the thousands. Mm-hmm. The trouble is that a 10-mile run may make your or my CPK fad go up into the hundreds.
Right.
So it's hard to make sense out of the CPK.
Okay. Sheila, thanks. I was going to say thanks for the call and thanks for listening.
And thank you.
All righty. Mary Ann, you're on line one.
Thank you, and I really have been appreciating this talk. I have two questions. I've been on statins for some years and had asked my doctor to let me get on, even though it was rather borderline, because I had heard that it could be useful in preventing dementia, and having had dementia in my family, was concerned about that. Second, I've had several DVTs. Most recently, I'm right now on blood thinners. And just wondered about the relationship between DVTs and whether statins help prevent that blood clotting problem. Thanks.
Okay.
That's a good question, worthy of research, both of them. And my understanding is negative, that we don't have substantial evidence that it interacts at all with dementia, or that it would interfere with change the proclivity towards DVT or blood clots in the legs. So, but I think that's sort of it's a vascular acting drug, statins are, and you kind of think, well, both of those are vascular processes, the DVT in the vein and the, in some people, the arterial circulation to the brain. But I think the preponderance of the evidence is no. But that's an excellent question, and one which you alone haven't had that's been researched, and I think negative.
Yeah, also, if one doesn't take for a few days or something, how is that an important? I mean, I take it daily, 5 milligrams, but have occasionally run out or missed and just go back to doing it when I get it filled up. It's probably not a major issue. I always feel
I would say
not really keeping me alive.
No, we think of it as longer term. And In my research in this area, some of the suggestions on how to help patients who are intolerant by muscle symptoms is to take it every other day. And that recommendation wouldn't be there if we thought it wasn't going to still be beneficial. And
I have never connected it with any other. I mean, I have all kinds of weird problems, but they never seem to be related to that. Any muscle things. I swim regularly, and that helps any other muscle problems I might have. So this has been helpful. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your call, and thanks for listening. Mm-hmm. Got an email, Casey. It says, how common are leg cramps? Slightly different question on as a side effect of statins. And at the same time, the writer wants to know, have they been associated with making restless leg syndrome worse? Both peripheral leg involved.
I piled through 50, 60 papers on this, and cramps per se, as we identify as that sudden pain that we find so difficult to cope with at night when you're asleep and all of a sudden you're fighting 7 out of 10 pain, not related. But muscle in general, and achiness in general, has been, 5%. But as far as the intermittent cramps, no. And it's one of the humbling things that we physicians have to contend with is muscle cramps. Difficult to have an easy solution. Quinine used to be prescribed, but it isn't apparently worth the side effects. The FDA took it off the market. And we have very little to do to offer for that. As far as the other question, which was
restless leg syndrome.
Restless legs, again, I didn't come across that. But one can understand that this all kind of overlaps, that you one might think that. Good questions, but I would say those two specific things, no, not related.
So, Tom, you're on line one.
Hi. I've been on statin for about 3.5 years. I used to be able to run. I've run half marathons and did the Lost Lake run. And since I've been on the statins, I've been on 3 or 4 different ones. I just cannot run anymore. So I don't have the muscle ache, but I don't seem to have any muscle strength either. And I wonder if there's any correlation with that.
Well, again, in an individual case, it's hard to know. I'm a runner as well, and sometimes I feel like I'm the last guy standing as I get into my 60s, and the people I used to run with have all stopped, and I kind of hurt when I do it, and I'm not taking a statin. You know, I think there's a natural aging out of running thing that happens that it's hard for us athletically oriented guys to admit to, but it happens to the best of us. So all I can say is that there's a 5% chance that your symptoms are related to it. And weakness in the muscles rather than pain is definitely part of the spectrum that the statins can do.
So, okay. So would it be reasonable? Let me just ask Tom's question for him. Would it be reasonable for Tom, since he's tried a couple of them, to stop them completely? And I know this is an individual decision, to see if his ability to run improved, and maybe that would help answer this question, or maybe it would just get more confusing.
Or switch to running, stay on the statin. So, yeah. Again, I go to the risk calculator to know what you're giving up.
All right.
I did quit for a few months, and it did not make any difference. So.
Okay. Which is not it's not proof that the statins are related, but it suggests to me that they may not be related.
There are rare events where people can have a long-standing muscle reaction to the use of statins. It is one case per doctor per lifetime kind of a thing. It's that rare. So it's no one can say no to that, but we can say statistically not likely.
Okay. Well, I blame it on Livelo, but I realize that what the statistics are. So
it would be a nice outcome if you were able to walk and still take them.
I can still walk. So, all right. Thank you very much.
Oh, we got one more question about the warning sections on a statin drug that might be related to ALS. Is this true for any or all of the statins? Apparently that's must be in the product literature.
Well, I think probably what it means is that ALS was reported after starting a statin.
Right.
And that would be a frightening thing if I was had the unluck of having ALS diagnosed and I had just started a statin. I would forever worry about that. I would always wonder, even though, you know, in all the information that I've gone over, I would always worry about it. It's hard to ignore it. But again, I would say we have nothing to support it. It gets reported, and one should keep an open mind that unusual things can eventually show up. But we've been using these drugs for 25 years.
So this is a probable coincidence causality argument. Just because something happens coincidentally doesn't mean that it's causal.
Right.
And we don't normally think like that. I tell patients every time I go to the barber, I seem to have less hair when I get out, but that doesn't mean that I have less hair because of the barber. And I don't want to be, risque about this. It's a common issue, but when you study thousands and thousands and thousands of people, there are going to be associations that just happen to happen. And it doesn't mean that they're related. Unfortunately, as you implied earlier, the FDA may require companies to put that in the product literature, but it may have nothing to do with the medication that's
there. Also a thing called selection bias. My favorite one of that is that red cars crash more frequently than blue cars do.
But it's
not the color of the car that's making it crash. It's the person who chooses it. The younger, livelier person picks the red car. But it's still a definite statistical association. Mm-hmm. So it may be that people who are in the process of developing ALS get to see a doctor. They can't find much wrong because in the early phases, it's hard to know if someone has it. They all go, by the way, you have a high cholesterol and you're old enough to benefit from it.
Right.
So it's a selection bias.
Right.
The people who are in the process of getting ALS, not yet diagnosed, see a doctor. And one of the more common things that happens appropriately in many of us is we get put on a statin as we approach our latter years.
Those are issues that it takes this idea of selection bias, confirmation bias, how we think, really takes a critical and open mind to really be asking ourselves, do I want to be right? Do I want to be right? Or do I really want to know what is right? And if you ask yourself, I really want to know what is right, it at least helps you try to take some of the biases that we bring into answering a question. We all want to be right, but that doesn't mean that's what is right. And it's difficult to really look at the quality of the data that's there and know how to judge it. I see this every day with people with immunization saying, I've reviewed all the information on immunizations and have made a decision that they're not safe. And yet the world's experts, including the public, often reading all the literature and people who know how to interpret that, really don't find that the risk of immunizations for most of us is that great. And so it's a little bit, I want to be right, not know what's right, that's driving that decision.
Right. And one of the studies that I didn't get a chance to talk about was published in the European Heart Journal at the beginning of the year. And it was a gentleman who studied the entire population of Denmark over 15 years and looked at the use of statins and found that the discontinuation of a started statin, they monitored everybody in the population. It's a central database. And they found that there was a correlation between negative news stories about statins and the discontinuation, and it was cumulative. So that after 15 years, the discontinuation rate went up from 4 to 5% up to 18%. Again, drugs same, dose same, people same, no change in genetics. What changed? The culture changed. So even though the majority of the articles were positive or neutral, there was accumulation over the time of thousands of articles that was written, and this included things online, things on the airwaves, and things in print, that you keep on remembering, oh, there's something wrong with statins. And so the culture becomes sensitized to the literature. And in our parents' era, again, not a lot of information about drugs and diseases in the newspaper. Now it's omnipresent. So there was a cultural shift, kind of like as you and I, Thad, were talking about, if you lived in Florida, and the only time you heard about Alaska was when there was a fatal bear attack, might you be afraid to come to Alaska because of the cumulative effect? But the statistical chance of a tourist being attacked by a bear is extremely low. Same thing, I think. We culturally are concerned with statins because of the accumulation over time. And that's what his study showed.
Which brings me to, where do people get information? And certainly social medias now are a big area of which I think people need to be very careful, but even the normal media. And here's a study that I had found that was done that showed they looked at reports of people stopping. The media reported that 20% of patients have stopped taking statins because of suspected side effects. Boom, that's the media release. That's the information. But what that information that came out of the media did not say was the rest of the story, which 35% of those who stopped restarted the treatment, and of those, 90% now tolerated the statins. Again, suggesting some other factor was causing them to have this pain. And then based on that information, they looked at 220,000 people in the United Kingdom that stopped statins based on this story, that led to an excess of 2,200 if two-thirds restarted the statins and 6,400 if nobody stopped, of avoidable cardiovascular disease. So because of this complaint of pain, somewhere between 2,200 and 6,400 had some kind of cardiovascular disease based on this story, which did not tell the whole story. And again, it gets to this quality of the evidence, and it doesn't mean it's even on purpose. Sometimes the people who are doing this reporting in the media are not good at interpreting the study. They're trying to sell a newspaper, which is really addressed at more
kind of explosive or certain headlines that grab people's attention, makes them want to read the paper.
Bear stories sell, and side effects to commonly used medications sells. So, and I think there's a cumulative effect over time. The Danish government put out their statistics saying that of the people that stopped the drugs, that was of the heart attacks that occurred during that 15-year period of observation, that 35% of them would have been prevented if they hadn't stopped the drug, and 1% of the cardiovascular deaths would have been prevented if they hadn't stopped the drug. So there's really a downside to stopping it statistically, it's not to be minimized. And I have yet to meet a journalist who knows how science really works. My criteria for that is a journalist who himself or herself has done a controlled experiment that was published or tried to be published, and that is rare. It's common in people who study science. I've never met a journalist who had done that. And that's what it really required to understand, for example, the difference between association and causation and how vitamin D might be associated with, low vitamin D is associated with all kinds of illnesses. But association isn't causation, and the analogy that gets people laughing is that Canadian geese are associated with water, and but that doesn't mean if you take Canadian geese and drag them to Arizona that there's going to be water there. And journalists never seem to get this. They say this is an association with, and all of a sudden your brain is making the connection, as you say, how our brain works, Thad.
We only got a couple of minutes. Well, actually, less than a minute now. Maybe real quick. What other things can be done to decrease cholesterol? It may be different. And the writer writes in, what about omega-3s? What about red yeast rice? Different other things. Are there other things that are as effective and perhaps safer? So that's the critical question in my mind. As effective and safer.
The red yeast, we would say no because we don't know if it's pure. And there was a... calcium supplements that had lead in them, that because the cows that were eating the grass were next to the leaded gasoline highways, and so that they weren't pure, and so we don't know if the red yeast is pure. There's been no studies to show. We know it lowers cholesterol, but is it pure enough to take? So, you know, remember that there was some bad calcium pills with contaminants. So it can happen. As far as the omega-3s, they have studied them and concluded that it is not worth pursuing. It was very sad to see it go because it's very appealing. It's part of our salmon, but no, the studies have dismissed it pretty much. Fiber intake absolutely will have many salutary effects and lower cholesterol. Metamucil, the psyllium, definitely lowers cholesterol. As far as the other topic, other ingredients of other medications, it's weak enough to dismiss most of them.
Thanks very much, Dr. Kaltenborg. We appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure.
To continue this discussion on statins and how to perhaps improve medical decisions, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at alaskapublic.org as well as our Line 1 archives. On our next Line 1, we're going to be discussing pediatric lung disorders and the effects of air quality on health with pediatric lung specialist Dr. Harry Wan. Why not join us next Monday at 2 p.m. for that program? Dave Waldron audio engineered today's program. I want to say thanks to him and to all of you who listen. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.